And it's this: as God gets smaller, we get bigger. We feel as though, maybe we wouldn't articulate it in this kind of an open way, but we kind of feel as though, as human beings, our perspective is actually quite vast. I've got a good lay of the land on how things are operating in my world and in the universe around me. We should be able to figure things out. We're entitled to an answer. Maybe this comes to, you know, more cosmic things. Maybe the answer for things in my life. Why did this happen? And why did the road take this kind of a twist and turn? We should have an answer. We can handle it. We can take it all in. That we should actually be able to see how life and eternity and God's purposes and plans fit together in that grand kind of scope. That God should let us in on more and more of these mysteries that are going on. We can take it. You know, we can take it. We've got broad shoulders. There's a book that we read with our kids sometimes. And it's kind of a ridiculous book, but it's a great book. And I can't really say the name of the book without cracking a smile, at least, because it's called Yertle the Turtle. It's a Dr. Seuss book, if you've ever read it. This is a bizarre transition. Hang with me. The gist of the story is this. There's a very arrogant turtle who lives in a pond. And that pond on its own is a wonderful place. And I could probably rattle off some of the stanzas from that. I'll save you all of that. But the pond was a lovely spot. You know, it was clean. I think that is part of the rhyme. It was clean and neat. There was plenty to eat, you know, this idea. But the problem arose, and I'm quoting, when Yertle decided the kingdom he ruled was too small. So what he ends up doing, this arrogant turtle, is coordinating, but in truth demanding that the other turtles form a tower under him. So there's a rock in the pond, and he commands that one of the turtles climb on top of the rock, and upon that turtle, Yertle makes his way on top, and his view's a little higher. And he likes the view, and his kingdom gets a little larger. So he demands that another one climbs on top, and another, and I forget, I didn't kind of count in the illustration, but I think there's some reference to a couple of dozen. So we'll say, by the time the tower climbs up in height further and further to the point where there's perhaps a couple of dozen turtles stacked one on top of the other, Yertle perches himself on the top, and he likes what he sees. So here he is a couple of dozen turtle shells high, and he's catching glimpses of things that he never could before at kind of pond level, where now he can see a field that he didn't before. Now he can see the tree and the house and the barn, and maybe in the distance a bit a road, as it were. Surely he was king of the world with this new perspective. And of course, the ridiculousness of that. We're like, yeah, supposing this were a true story, which I don't think it is. I didn't research it, but supposing it were a true story, and you think the absurdity of this, that big deal, you can see 24 turtle shells high around this tiny little area in a tiny little town in this county, in this province, in this country. What, you get the picture. And of course, it's a Dr. Seuss book, and it's for kids, I think, although I think most of them are for young and young at heart. It's cleverly written. In the end, there's a good lesson. But in all seriousness, I wonder sometimes how much our thinking about God resembles Yertle the Turtle. My perspective is quite vast. I should be able to figure things out. I'm kind of entitled to an explanation as to how the sovereign God of the universe chooses to operate, as though I am able to understand what the eternal Lord and Creator of all things is doing, simply because I've piled up some shells that I can climb upon. I'm afraid that our perspective of God is far too small. I did some digging around this week, and this goes back to where I began with my university career, I guess you'd say, in the world of realm of science. And I love kind of cosmology and so on. I love sort of reading about the universe and planets and galaxies and how that all works. And one of my most dear favorite professors I ever had the privilege of learning from, who was, of course, I met him in a Christian context, but his whole training and his whole career before that were very much in a secular context in the science world. And he would say the most God-fearing people in the world are physicists, are planetary physicists who understand kind of a little better than the average bear how the galaxies and sort of the universe is put together. He said these are the most God-fearing people on the planet. Whether or not they would kind of describe themselves that way, they are. But I went kind of digging around this week with all of that in mind and our scope and our place in the world and our size, and I kind of punched in the question, how big is the universe? Well, honestly, and I love that you'll find really technical explanations for things. You'll see really good guesstimates, but even the sharpest people are quick to say, well, maybe some are rather reluctant, but ultimately to say, we really don't know. We really don't know. But a best guess is 27.6 billion light years wide. And that's not an easy measurement to conceptualize, because there we kind of have space and distance and time, history kind of all converging at once. That's a difficult thing to grasp, but to say one light year is the distance that that light travels in 365.25 days. Light travels at 186,000 miles per second, so get your pencil sharp. 27.6 billion light years wide is quite large, without me getting into much more explanation beyond that. Simply a picture of how large, how vast, how complicated, how mysterious the universe where we reside is, and out of that, an indicator that those same traits are borne by its creator. So to say, if we think the universe is vast and mysterious and just kind of wow, then it pales in comparison even to its creator. Consider this kind of mind blown. I saw this demonstration before where astronomer took a piece, I think a grain of salt, but you could substitute for a grain of sand. Maybe you could get really ambitious and put a gigantic kind of kernel of corn on the end of your finger. So imagine this, that you could stand out here in the field, look up at the clear sky, and hold that grain of whatever on your finger, right, so you can catch that. You know how you can kind of close one eye and then the other, and you see it from a different angle, but let both of your eyes kind of focus together in that kind of binocular kind of a way, looking toward the sky. Now imagine the piece of sky that kernel of corn or that grain of sand covers. It's not that big, right, when you think of an earthly perspective and holding that. But kind of capture that mental picture and that amount of sky. How many other grains of sand how many other people have to hold to kind of cover all of the sky? I've got a picture I want you to see. Some years back, of course, you're familiar with the Hubble telescope it's a space telescope, so it doesn't reside here on Earth. They put it in space to say we'll get even a better view of things. Just as a ballpark, that is the amount of space and sky that would be covered by one grain of salt focused in on by the Hubble telescope. Each of these kind of swirly bits that you see represents a galaxy, which in each of those galaxies, there are typically millions and sometimes billions of stars. Now, we know our most, warm, fuzzy star, that is the sun, that's here in our system, in the solar system, and it's actually not a very big star as stars go. But just to give you a bit of a scope of, oh my goodness, imagine all the grains of sand and all the people standing with them at arm's length to kind of patchwork together all over the globe. And this is the view that we get of the sky that is covered by one grain. Mind-bending, isn't it? As we think this through. And I share all this not to dazzle with you. I get excited about science from time to time. But I share all of this not to dazzle you with just the vastness of the cosmos, but instead to impress upon you just how small we are. And at the same time, that'd be discouraging if it was just, you're small. Go home, think about that. How small we are, and how immeasurable and vast and huge our God is. And the scriptures speak again and again and again and again and again about God, his unlimited power and his scope and his might and his majesty and his sovereignty. We read things like Psalm 115, our God is in the heavens and he does as he wishes. And you might be the deist agnostic type and say, well, there, see, God is in the heavens and he does whatever he wants. Doesn't really care that much about my life and yours. He's not particularly involved. Sure, there's a God and he creates whatever. No, this is what our God is like. He stands above and beyond all eternity. His vision and his scope are not limited in any way. You know how we live in the moment and we kind of see a piece of what is? Well, imagine a God who transcends, who is outside of time. And if you grew up in a time of movie reels, which I did, whatever, don't judge me, all you young people, in school, you know, we'd show movies and it was movie reels. There was no digital version of it, but if you could unroll even a movie reel of all of time, of all eternity somehow, and God can just see it all at once. We see this microscopic part. We reside in it. God is not bound by space and time and our understanding. But then we move from the God who resides in the heavens and does as he pleases. We dial it in because he is personal. He is involved. He is sovereign. Psalm 139, you made all the delicate inner parts of my body and knit me together in my mother's womb. Thank you for making me so wonderfully complex. You'll know that, many of you. I am fearfully, wonderfully made. Your workmanship is marvelous. How well I know it. You watched me as I was being formed in utter seclusion, as I was woven together in the dark of the womb. You saw me before I was born. Every day of my life was recorded in your book. Every moment was laid out before a single day had passed. This is what our God is like. We dial it in even further. God's Son is sent, and we read in the Gospels, here is flesh and blood what God is like. Jesus tells us in Matthew's Gospel, what is the price of two sparrows? One copper coin, but not a single sparrow can fall to the ground without your Father knowing it. That's the level of our God's involvement in all that he's created. Another story in the Gospel, a famous one, where Jesus is with his disciples, fishermen. They're in a boat, and the storm rages to the point where they think they're going to die. There's no other option. Jesus is resting in the back, in the bottom of the boat. And they finally go to stir him, scared that they are going to drown and die imminently. So they stir him. Don't you care that we're dying, we're going to drown? Jesus promptly wakes up, stands up, and in essence says, knock it off to the wind and the waves, and goes back to rest once again. And the storm is calmed, and the seas are flat. This is the Lord of all things. He is completely in control of all things at all times. He's aware of all things at all times. He's all-powerful. And from our perspective, our limited, finite, sitting in the pond perspective, he is mysterious in what he does and how he moves. How could he not be? We are not on his level. We're not on the same plane. We're not in the same conversation. He's just different than us, wholly other. That's a long intro. I share all of that with you to say these are the kind of glasses that we put on when we read a passage like Ecclesiastes chapter 3. This is the kind of perspective that we bring when we approach such words. So it's through these kind of lenses that we want to enter in to this morning and to this third chapter. And here's what often happens when we read this text. Well, first off, we have the bird's tune. Do everything, turn, 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 right? If you're a great song, this is from the words from which it's written. So maybe you have the bird's melody rolling around your head. But we read it often from a human-centric point of view, as though Ecclesiastes 3 and this rather poetic beginning to it is somehow kind of a, It's kind of a choose-your-own-adventure book. It's a menu. It's different electives that we might choose, as though this is from life's buffet. Here's what I mean. We might read through Ecclesiastes chapter 3 and see this as kind of an optional list. Like, this is all kind of based on choice. Like, at every verse, it's like, would you rather be a hammer or a nail? So, you know, verse 1, it's a time to be born, a time to die. Well, I'm taking being born. A time to plant, a time to harvest. Well, you know, I kind of like to harvest. Time to kill, time to heal. I'm not going to even speculate which one you might choose on that. A time to tear down, a time to build up. Well, I like to build things. Time to cry, time to laugh, time to grieve, time to dance. None of us are good dancers. Forget. A time to scatter stones, a time to gather stones, a time to embrace, a time to turn away, a time to search, a time to quit searching. A time to keep, a time to throw away, a time to tear, a time to mend, a time to be quiet, a time to speak, a time to love, a time to hate, a time for war, and a time for peace. So it's like we can navigate through and say, well, I'm just glad that not many of those things are going to happen to me. And if I have my choice, which I probably do, then I'm choosing this. I'm going to just believe God for only good things and navigate my way through these waters. And it's a real interesting piece of poetry that we find here. But, you know, beyond that, that section of Scripture is nice. But here's the honest and the sobering truth. What if this list is actually not a list of electives or choices or options for us to choose? But what if what we find here is actually a list of ingredients in a recipe that God puts together in our lives, that He fashions, that will actually be part of our existence as human beings in this world? Because here's the reality, we're really okay with the positives. We're really okay with the pleasant options. I know I am. Peace and love and quiet and healing and dancing and laughter. And all of those things are absolutely gifts from God. They really and truly are. But we're often just not okay with the others. And if, when those things come our way, I should be able to understand what's happening here, God. Let me in on this. I can take it. I've got big shoulders. My perspective is pretty good. And what if our sovereign God is so big, so great, that His perspective and His ways are so perfect that somehow He allows us to experience many of these not so nice things? The heartbreak and the sorrow and the tragedy, because He has a purpose behind it. And man, that is hard for us sitting in the pond at that level to get our heads around, to understand, to make any sense of, to process. But what if it's true? Verse 11, we read this. Yet God has made everything beautiful for its own time. He's planted eternity in the human heart. But even so, people cannot see the whole scope of God's work from beginning to end. Can I just reread that? Even so, people cannot see. People, that's me and that's you and that's us. We cannot see the whole scope of God's work from beginning to end. We just can't. We can't. We couldn't if He laid it out before us, I don't think. We just can't. And we can muse. And I think it's okay to muse. It really is. I think it's okay to question. I think it's okay to doubt. It's okay to lament and to recoil at times. It's okay to ask, why did this happen to me? Why did I have to experience this in my life? Why did this tragedy befall me? Why did we lose this person? Why did the road take this sharp turn in this direction? How does this make any sense? I don't know. But God is not setting out to cause you harm. He certainly is not. But we must maintain at least some perspective that leaves room that God allows some of these things to befall us. that it's through the struggle that God is bringing about his purposes, actually making all things beautiful in its time. I grew up singing that song in my little country church. In his time, he makes all things beautiful in his time. You know that song, perhaps, too. Those words flow and roll off our tongues really easily. Do I believe them? Do we really believe those words? And the thing is, there's lots and lots and lots of you, even in a small room like this today, there's lots of you who know and love and walk with Jesus who could actually testify to things that you have experienced and witnessed and endured that on their own have just been awful. But through time, often the long haul, and bit of a sidebar, I don't think we're guaranteed at all in this life to be let in on the why. Sometimes we are. I think more often than not, we're not. But there are many of you who could testify to these experiences and how formative and ultimately with God at work in what would have otherwise just been awful, God actually comes good on this and he makes it beautiful, something that is just in and of itself unbearable and even wicked and terrible. And our God is so great, his scope is so vast that he's even able to redeem and leverage those things for beauty, for his glory, and even for our joy. Where you've actually been in that spot of how could anything redemptive, positive, much less beautiful ever come from this circumstance, come from this season? And in time, lo and behold, God does make something beautiful, and faith is born again and again and stretched and deepened in a way that you would never have experienced were it not for that thing. I came across this brilliant quote this past week that was just right in the wheelhouse of this passage. I've got it on the screen so you can see it too. Could it be that the puncture wounds in the canvas of your life, the losses, the disappointments, the crushing blows might actually become the rent places of the soul through which you can see God, through which you can peer beyond your earthly trappings into glory moments beyond, through which you can see his light bursting through the openings? I believe they could be. What a beautiful picture of what that might look like in our lives. Our God is far bigger than we can know or even imagine. He is all-powerful. He's all-knowing. He's all-loving. His sight and his perspective are complete and perfect and good. Not only can we trust him, we can have confidence that his ways and his plans are actually good, even when everything else would tell us the opposite. That he and he alone is really able to make things beautiful according to his plans and ways. And the teacher, Solomon, goes on, verse 12, "So I concluded there is nothing better than to be happy and enjoy ourselves as long as we can, and people should eat and drink and enjoy the fruits of their labor, for these are gifts from God. And I know whatever God does is final. Nothing can be added to it or taken from it. God's purpose is that people should fear him. What is happening now has happened before. What will happen in the future has happened before, because God makes the same things happen over and over again." What an amazing thing to even just consider with a big view, not a small view, a big view of God in mind, that he might just be up to something even in allowing the difficult things to come our way, that he gives purpose and is able to bring about beauty, redeeming the tough stuff for his glory and ultimately for our good. I want to close this morning with a testimony, a really compelling chapter in someone's life. Some of you know her and might even know her story. Lots of you wouldn't. It doesn't matter. But sat down with her and captured a recent chapter that of her life that she's been through, and captured that on video, which is awesome, where more people can even be encountered with what God is doing in her life. And I'd love to share that with you now as we close.
And you have struggled with physical pain for a long time. Just describe some of that over the years of your life.
Well, being a nurse of 35 years and on my feet for 12-hour shifts at a time, I have had a lot of sciatic pain in my left leg, and that's been tolerable, but it's been a long process over the course of 20 years. And I've gone to, I've tried medication, I've tried chiropractors, I've, done a lot of things to try to improve the situation, but I have lived with a certain amount of pain for a long time.
Tell us about January 6th, 2017.
January 6th, that would be the day that I came into the hospital to have surgery on my left knee. I had had a torn cartilage, and I had waited for approximately 9 months and tried to work limping and having quite a bit of discomfort in that knee for those 9 months. And January 6th came in and had a day surgery, and everything went well, and I returned home the same day. So after my surgery, for the first week, I just was regular post-op discomfort. And then things changed. My sciatic pain became unbearable to the point that I couldn't sit for longer than 30 seconds. I couldn't lie down with great comfort. I was, up and down. I could walk a little bit, but just excruciating pain. And I tried to manage that on my own for about 3 weeks. I couldn't bear the pain.
There's a moment where you ask for Doug to get a book to just place under your hip to help alleviate some pain. Kind of talk us through that.
Kind of a point of desperation. I had tried everything, done everything in my power to help the situation. So I asked Doug to grab a book out of the bookcase, and I just was looking for a little bit of relief. And so he did. He gave me this book, and he helped position it under my hip, and I only had it there for about 10 minutes. And then he helped me up off the couch again to my feet, and I looked down at the book, and it brought back a memory. My mom, who has been dead now for 19 years, had given me that book when I was about 13, 14 years old. And I had read mostly every part of that book, and it was really, really special to me. And the title of the book was "With God, All Things Are Possible." And God really spoke to me at that moment, and he also spoke to Doug, and we went out to the kitchen, and I stood by the counter, and I said, "Let's read what this book says about health and healing." And in the book, it talked quite strongly how God can miraculously heal you physically immediately and with faith. And I have read the Bible so many times where you just need faith as a grain of mustard seed. And we prayed, and I did have faith that God could just heal me in an instant. But the chapter also went on to say that sometimes God chooses to heal you in another direction, and that's through
the understanding that God was going to heal you through doctors and nurses and medicines, where your body started to shut down, where you were becoming paralyzed. Walk us through that moment.
Well, there was a lot of confusion when I first was admitted, and the tests came back revealing that I had had a significant spinal stenosis of my neck, which was critical, and I didn't have any clue that I had anything wrong with my neck. The only thing I knew that I had was pain in my sciatica, and it also brought up to the front that I had significant stenosis in my lower back as well. So it was a multitude of problems for the doctors to solve, and the first one being my neck was critical. And over the course of 5 days, I went to the point of being able to walk in the hall with a walker, with assistance. My husband was with me, and I just started shutting down. You know, every 12 hours, something else, you know, gave way. And 5 days later, I was paralyzed from the neck down.
There seems to have been many moments where you're in a bad place, your mind no doubt filled with fear, nervousness, and oddly enough, there's a doctor who is present who is a believer and prays with you, someone who knows you who's a believer prays with you. Talk us through the ironic moments where you're in a place of need and someone is there to meet and pray with you.
Heather Reed came in, and I looked terrified, and she just immediately started to pray, and I sensed God's presence and peace and comfort, even though I was still scared, but I knew that God was in control. Well, right after Heather prayed, and everybody seemed to be, you know, running to the phone and ordering this and ordering that. And Carl Friedrich had met Doug in the hall and found out that I was in and the seriousness of the situation. And he immediately came to my bedside. And working in a hospital, when you have a doctor that is willing to hold your hand and lift the name of Jesus and pray with you, that was just such a special moment. And that just, I can't explain how God filled everything that I needed and gave me the strength through prayer.
There is a passage in Luke where Jesus comes to Simon Peter and says, "Simon, Satan has asked me to sift you, and I've said yes, but don't worry, I'm going to pray for you." In your life, could this moment have been one of these moments where it can knock you off the rail, and yet because of your leaning into Jesus, your faith actually grows in a way that you didn't really think possible?
Most definitely. That's not the first time that I've gone through something like that, but this time I was so overwhelmed with pain and couldn't focus on anything else but Christ. And that's the only thing that I could hold on to. And yes, my faith is so much stronger.
Of God, and out of that, our, with Ecclesiastes in mind, our business is not outcomes or us being able to somehow see all that is at play and at work, but our business, our response as God's children, is to trust that have faith, to trust Him with whatever comes our way, knowing that He's good.